Sherman and Sterling?
Sherman and Sterling, yes.
Sherman, okay.
Sherman.
Is that Sherman? Okay.
It's Sherman.
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 All right.
Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert.
Well, Greg, we talk a lot about the future of the legal profession. You know, what is the skill set of the next gen lawyers? How will law firm operations function? You and I talk about it, but our guest, Jennifer Leonard, Chief Innovation Officer at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School and the Executive Director of the Future of the Profession Initiative there at Penn Law, she lives it.
Yes, she does.
Jennifer is part of a group at Penn Law working on the initiative, along with an all-star cast advisory board. And as we will discuss, they have the financial backing to make some things happen. It was a fun and inspiring conversation, and I think everyone will enjoy it.
Yeah, this was definitely, I'm not afraid to say, this was one of my favorites discussions
uh-oh,
that we've had.
Oh, so you put that out there.
I did.
Put that out there.
And it was one of our previous guests, Adam Sow, from a few episodes ago, who connected us with Jennifer, and we're very happy that he did. So there's just a lot of great things happening with this initiative.
That's right. Our interview's coming up later, but first, let's get to this week's Information Inspirations.
So, Marlene, there's a very interesting webinar coming up next week on May 12th called Storytelling, How to Bridge the Gap Between Small and Big Data. So Anthony Woodup, who's the Global Director of Legal Project Management at Sherman and Sterling, and Jessica Davis, Director of Matter Performance and Service Innovation at McCarter & English, along with Peter Vanderhoeven, who's the co-founder and CEO at Clocktimizer, are going to talk about the difference between big and small data and why it should be treated differently. They'll also cover how to properly extract that data to tell the right story and identify tools to help tell that story. In this instance, Clocktimizer is going to be one, but I think our guests last week, Ryan McLeod and Nicole Braddock, would toss up Map Engine in there as well.
That's so, right.
You know, this type of webinar looks like it was just custom made for us.
Yeah, I'm actually going to go check that link out and sign up for that because that sounds great. And I swear, we don't actually talk to one another about our inspirations beforehand. And we're
Did
talking
you have
about,
this one?
Well, no. We're talking about data extraction, yeah. And I'm looking at mine, and I'm saying, okay, so one of our former guests, Sarah Lynn, has a new article out entitled 10 Ways Data Science Can Help Librarians. It's really a wonderful article. It's very full of practical reasons why data science should be part of your regular routine. And her tips really are not just for librarians. Her first tip is basically to learn R. That's the cornerstone for all the rest of the tips. R can help you tidy data, so normalizing columns, formatting dates and times, and combining data from different sources. And this is, we're talking about things that Excel can't handle.
Yeah.
R has a graphics package, so you can use it to create visualizations, both static and dynamic. And R supports many file outputs, so it's an effective tool for dynamic analysis documents. Sarah actually wrote the article in R and published it to Word, and she could have published it to HTML, Notebook, PowerPoint, or a variety of other formats. You can also use R for web scraping and connecting databases and text mining.
I don't know if you know this, but I have programmed in R before. So.
I do know that. I remember talking about that. I remember the scraping project. Yes.
Yep.
And Sarah notes that sites such as Stackflow and R communities are great places to learn what R packages will work best for your project. And, you know, maybe you need to talk to Greg, too, since he's an expert.
Yeah, it really is. It looks daunting, but it's really not that hard. And having these communities, and I know Sarah works at R, but there's all these other communities out there that can help you learn how to use that. And in fact, I find it easier to use than Python.
Yeah, I mean, I took a couple of those online courses about, you know, how to do R, and it really doesn't seem to be that hard.
Well, Marlene, my next inspiration could either go down as the day a law firm actually did something really cool with technology, or it could go down as the day that NFTs Jump the Shark. So K&L Gates wrote a client alert on NFTs or non-fungible tokens. And Marlene, guess what they did with this client alert?
Please tell me.
Yeah, so they minted it into its very own NFT, making it the first law firm client alert to be issued as an NFT. So
there you go.
Yeah. So the K&L Gates is looking to actually auction this off to one of its own lawyers with all of the funds going to local charities. And I have no idea how much they're going to raise with this thing. I will say I talked to another attorney about this, and he said, you know what's cooler than this? Is it practically anything? So. So I think we have at least one vote for jumping the shark.
Well, we all know that many legal tech vendors have attorneys on staff to sell and support products. Some of these products have even been designed by attorneys. But it seems law departments are asking for firsthand experience from their vendor partners, attorney or not. A recent article on law.com suggests that firsthand experience with specific problems faced is really what law departments are after. And they are demanding it, not only from their vendors, but also their employees. They're looking for candidates with previous legal ops experience. As we know, Deloitte just hired Bob Taylor, and Onnit recruited TIAA Chief Operations Officer Brad Rogers to serve as the new Vice President of Strategy and Growth. And Jack Thompson, Assistant Director of Global eDiscovery and Legal Operations at Sanofi, who, by the way, is not a lawyer, said that he prefers to see substance or quality of work, not the credentials or degrees of an individual providing expertise and knowledge. I think this is great and smart, you know, but I hope legal departments don't go down that very narrow road that many firms do now and just hire simply based on whether a candidate has had similar experience in the past. I mean, that is obviously an important and definite consideration, but I hope they continue to look outside of the small world of legal ops for leaders and visionaries that can bring fresh problem-solving approaches to the table.
Yeah, if they're not careful, they're going to wind up doing exactly what you think, and that is they're going to hire someone with the same experience with them that just happens to also look a lot like they do as well.
I had a feeling you were going to say that.
Well, that wraps up this week's Information Inspirations. So we have our own ideas of what the future of the legal profession might look like, but with support from a top law school, a world-class board of advisors, and substantial funding, today's guest is not only envisioning the future of the profession, she is leading an initiative to help shape it.
We'd like to welcome Jennifer Leonard, Chief Innovation Officer at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School and the Executive Director of the Future of the Profession Initiative there at Penn Law. Jennifer, welcome to the Geek in Review.
Thank you so much for having me. So nice to meet you, Marlene and Greg.
So the Future of the Profession Initiative, or FPI for short, that sounds like a really big initiative to take on. So in prep for this interview, I reached out to Joe Borstein, who's on the advisory board for FPI, and he mentioned that in November of 2019, the W.P. Carey Foundation made a $125 million gift to the law school at the University of Pennsylvania. And apparently that's like the largest gift ever to a law school, not just to Penn, but to any law school. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
One of the things that he said, that Joe said that he really loved about FPI, is that you guys do have the money behind the program to do some great things. So you got the money. How did you decide to start this initiative? And it's the overall mission of the future of the profession.
Sure. So huge thanks to the Carey Foundation for its record-breaking gift to the law school, which allows us to do many different things across the institution, including turbocharging some of the things that we had been doing through FPI. And a thanks to Joe, who is one of our most enthusiastic supporters and member of our advisory board. And I know we'll talk about them in a little bit as well. It's interesting the way that the timing unfolded, because we had actually been talking at the law school since April of 2018 about what we wanted to think about in terms of innovation in law schools. And we had a really broad charge with an internal working group from our dean, recognizing that the world is changing really rapidly, recognizing that a leading law school has an opportunity and an obligation to be on top of that change, to be developing responsive programming and curriculum and conversations. And he really wanted us to think deeply about what that response would look like. And we worked internally with about 24 people from all across the law school. We looked at law school initiatives across the country to see what people were doing, the many different forms that innovation projects take, and what we could do in our role as Penn Law and playing to the strengths that we play to, which are interdisciplinary approaches to problem solving and translating what we're doing at a really world-class research institution in a way that impacts the real world. And then we brought on a group of advisory board members who occupy all different positions across the legal profession, and we asked them what they were seeing from their vantage points. And they're really diverse in their roles, in their sectors, in their levels of seniority in these different organizations. So we got a really rich blend of perspectives that informed what ultimately became the Future of the Profession initiative. And we named the project really specifically that we are taking initiative. We are not just looking at what is happening, but we are working actively to be a part of that dynamic landscape. And so FPI actually was already prepared to launch when the Carey Foundation made its historic gift to the law school. And what the gift allowed us to do was really to take flight at a very early stage with what we knew was an exciting and ambitious idea. And since the gift came into the law school, as I said, it's amplified everything that we wanted to do and allowed us to have some really huge successes early on that included a major two-day launch event at the Pennovation Center in Penn that was a global conversation about the future of the profession, attracted thousands of viewers online virtually, and over 200 in person in Philadelphia. We were able to bring on two new team members, including senior consultant and Penn Law alum and president emeritus of the Legal Services Corporation, Jim Sandman, who is a vocal advocate around regulatory reform in the profession so that he can develop projects for real impact. And we brought on board our first innovator in residence, Miguel Willis, who is the founder and executive director of Access to Justice Tech Fellows, which is now formally affiliated with FPI and focuses on developing summer opportunities for students in law schools across the country to learn how to leverage data, design thinking, and technology to scale access to justice. And we did a whole host of other programming initiatives, webinars, podcasts, newsletters, and all of that was a result of the great timing that we had in having this project ready to launch and the gift coming in at the same time.
Now, before we go on, did I hear you right? It's called the Pennovation Center?
That's right. It's actually called Pennovation Works, and it's an entire campus on the south side of the university that is dedicated to being an incubator for startups and taking advantage of the really, really mature and vibrant innovation ecosystem across Penn's campus and putting it in one location to put all of that power to work for the entrepreneurs that occupy that building. It's a really cool space, and it was the perfect venue for our launch.
Well, whoever the marketing person was for that they hit a home run on that one.
Give him a raise. That's a good one. That's a good one.
Done. It was an amazing event, and I'm happy to share the link if it's helpful for your listeners. You can watch all the content online.
Yeah, definitely. This all sounds amazing. So Penn Law is one of the top law schools in the country, and I imagine that almost all of your graduates can, you know, pretty much write their own ticket on careers that they want to dive into. So what are Penn Law students getting out of this initiative, and what is Penn Law seeking to develop within the students who take part in the FPI? And I'll add to this that I did note in your earlier comments that this is actually benefit going out to students in other schools. So would love to hear a little bit more about that too.
Sure. You know, we are so fortunate to have, I think, one of the most amazing, brilliant student bodies in our community and the future leaders of our profession, which is really why we want to use FPI to equip them with both the knowledge of what's happening in the profession, the changes taking place, some of the dynamics happening, and the exciting career opportunities that are unfolding in different areas of the legal profession, And also equipping them with the skills and mindset they need to be the problem solvers of the future. Because we know, and the point of your podcast, the point of your work is how quickly things are changing in the profession. And, you know, senior leaders who occupy the profession now, we're not taught in law school, right? By and large, how to have a multidisciplinary approach to problem solving, how to leverage frameworks like design thinking and using technology and data to create better solutions to design better legal systems. And we know that if we can harness the brilliance of our student body and equip them with that knowledge, that they will be the leaders of the future of the profession. So through additions to our curriculum, Miguel, our board member, Claudia Johnson, Jim, and I, and a variety of other faculty members teach courses in the upper level in particular about all of these topics. And those topics are infused not only in a single standalone course, but throughout our entire curriculum. We've also, you know, one of the hallmarks of our project is that it really focuses on the holistic formation of a lawyer, not only her critical thinking skills and her legal research and writing and clinical and all of the wonderful things that go into our world-class education, but the lawyer as a person, right? The professional identity formation and the self-care and well-being aspects of being a professional in a very stressful environment. So we've integrated into all of our upper-level professional responsibility courses a module on the connection between attorney well-being and ethical obligation to our clients, where we have explicit conversations about that stress, what some of the underlying causes are, and some adaptive behaviors that our students can use to respond well so that they can serve their clients and society as a whole in a better way. So we're really weaving in different ways to prepare them for all the dynamic and exciting opportunities on the horizon.
I think it's great that you're basically immersing the students throughout their career with this information and these courses. I'm wondering, do they come in sort of eager to learn this stuff or expecting to learn this stuff, or do they already know some of these things? What I'm thinking about is, okay, we take Spanish in eighth grade and by then it's too late. So I'm wondering, you know, are they learning this stuff ahead of time, or is this like their first exposure, and how are they responding to it?
Yeah. And I want to add on to that if I can. And that is, mm-hmm. we've run into issues where the students, if it's not on the bar, they don't want to even talk about it. It has no importance to them. It's what's on the bar. I got to study for that. I'll take care of the rest of it later.
Now, I would say I have found quite the opposite in my work. Our students are really eager to be creative, to think about new solutions. This whole generation of law students, not only at Penn, but just nationwide, globally, are so much savvier when they come into law school than we were. There's so much more information out there for them to inform themselves in advance. So many of them come in with a really remarkably strong idea, maybe not of exactly what they want to do with a law degree, but why they're there in the first place and all of the resources they want to take advantage of while they're with us on campus. And then another thing that I didn't talk about yet, but part of FPI's mission, part of the law school's mission as a whole, is to develop a relationship with our students that carries forward beyond graduation into a model of continuous lifelong learning, recognizing that the future will require continual learning and unlearning and rethinking and developing new approaches. We start at the JD level by teaching them the mindset for learning and growth and change and creativity. But then we don't leave them just with that. We want to be connected with them and supporting them at different points in their career where there's greater context around the lessons that we're teaching them, the frameworks they can use, and the strategies they can deploy in thinking about their own career evolution. Marlene, to your point about, you know, is it almost too late when they get there to teach them these things, or do they know these things in advance? I think they come in very, very knowledgeable. What we can do is take them in a structured way and help guide them and support them through this very rigorous academic experience, and also equip them with really powerful tools that they can use on the other side. So even if they come in conceptually knowing about some of the challenges, what we're doing is equipping them with the tools to respond to them. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that you kind of mentioned in there is the continual evolution of the student once they've graduated and are a lawyer. One of the programs I saw that this initiative wants to do is a what's called the 5-year out academy, where when they're in their fifth year, once they've graduated law school, that you reach back out to them and have this academy with them. Can you I know it hasn't started yet, but can you explain the process and idea behind that?
Sure. So the idea really is that we teach them a tremendous amount during the 3 years in the JD program and all of the great curriculum, fabulous faculty, all the things that we've referenced earlier. But we also know, as you both know, as I know from people who've been in their careers for a while, that you get to a point in your career where you need new skills and you need new information and you need a new infrastructure to support you in thinking about the next stage. And for lawyers, when our internal working group thought about it, talked about it, we identified the 5-year mark as a time when practicing attorneys have enough substantive experience in sort of the junior level work to be thinking about where they are headed for the next chapter of their career. And whether that is in a big law firm where they are thinking about maybe becoming a partner or ascending to senior associateship, we all know that the skills that they will need to move to that chapter are very different from the skills that they need in the junior level of practice. It relates more to business development, to cultivating and leading inclusive teams, to managing up, down, and around, to bringing in multidisciplinary points of view to help you solve new problems, to finance and accounting, right? So for some people who are, especially if you're moving into the public interest or government arena, you're taking on heightened responsibility at a lower or more junior level in your career. So you need to be equipped with skills that you may not have learned necessarily in law school, or you've forgotten, or you didn't have context around. So the idea of the 5-year out academy is our invitation to our alumni who are 5 years out at that point in their career, no matter where they are, no matter what they're doing, to come back to us and to spend some time with us and with one another in an executive ed type format that will equip them with some of those frameworks, skills, strategies that they can use to move successfully into that next chapter.
That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it does.
Thank you. We had planned to roll it out in May of 2020. And of course, we all know what happened in 2020. And at the beginning, it's interesting the way it evolved, because in last May, it was just too chaotic to figure out exactly what to do. And this May, I think we feel that people have been on Zoom so frequently, people have Zoom fatigue at this point, that what we'd like to do is look to May 2021. And I think it will also be a richer experience now that we've been through this turbulent time to think about new topics. How are we leading through constantly shifting ground? How are we building in more multidisciplinary aspects, even to the 5-year out academy? Are we connecting with other graduate students who can help our students think in different ways and open their minds to different approaches to problem solving? But I think we will have much deeper content and discussions based on the experience we've all just had in our final iteration next year.
And just to clarify, I think you meant May 2022, right?
I did. Did I say 2021? Yes, don't hold me to that. 2022.
Because I was going to say, otherwise it's too
nothing
late.
Nothing is ready for next month.
It's like, good luck with that.
Thank you so much for that. Woo.
No problem. So a few weeks ago, we talked with Adam Sow, who's an alumni there at Penn, and he was really excited about this program, and he reached out and connected us with you. But he's not the only connection that we have there, and many of our listeners, they know some of the people involved with FBI. For example, your board of advisors includes some names we know, such as Joe Borstein, who we mentioned earlier, who was formerly with Ernst & Young and now is with LexFusion, Susan Raridan Lambeth of LawVision, and David Perla, who many of our listeners knew him from his Bloomberg Law days, and now he's at Burford Capital. How are you leveraging this wealth, this brain trust of alumni to help guide you on your mission at FBI?
They are by far our most potent tool in making this what it is. They have been incredibly supportive and involved and engaged from the start. The breadth of their experience and the diversity of their experience is really what we want as we're trying to pull together what is frequently a very siloed profession, where big law partners talk to big law partners and public interest lawyers talk to public interest lawyers, judges talk to judges. This group covers such a wide array of roles, and they are creative, they are entrepreneurial, they are excited about this project. And so we still continue to meet with them monthly and engage them, not only in sort of a standard meeting where you go through an agenda with updates, but we bring in guest speakers for them to listen to from other disciplines, from people at Penn, so that they can connect with our interdisciplinary network at Penn that we have the advantage of connecting with on a regular basis. We involve them in projects. We had a meeting this week to talk about our next major conference, and each of them will play a role in helping us craft what will be a really well-designed event that speaks to all of these different stakeholders, which is really challenging to do. And we couldn't do it without having all of them in the room. And you mentioned some of our fantastic board members. We also have Sozi Tulante, who is a partner at Deckard. We have Judge Stella Tsai, who's an alum, and she's a trial court judge in Philadelphia. So she works in a court system with big city challenges. She's also focused on really amplifying the work of Asian and women attorneys in particular. We have Madhav Srinivasan, who is CFO at Hunt and Andrews Kurth. So he is really looking at the business side, the financial side of big law. Aaron Katzel at SoftBank. We have Claudia Johnson at Pro Bono Net, who has dedicated her whole life to issues of equity and public interest, but also is really open to the connection between corporate legal services and the public interest. And we just added in the last year Tiffany Sutherland and Ray Hedden, who are both alumni. Tiffany is the chief diversity officer at Troutman Sanders. And we really want to be thinking more about integrating equity and inclusion in everything that we do. And what I think is so cool about our group is that you would think you would get into the group and the same thing that happens in the profession would happen in the group. Like the people who are into legal tech would go together and the people in the public interest would go together. And there's such a deep respect for everybody's experience and a genuine desire to be learning from each other. I don't know how it happened. They're just such an amazing group of people, but that's the special sauce that makes us unique, I think, is that ability to pull together and really connect collaboratively to design something holistic.
Yeah, I would love to be the virtual fly on the Zoom wall when you guys are having this call. So,
they're the best meetings.
I know any one of those people could just take up all the time with all the ideas that they have, and having them all together, it must whoever does the time management has their work cut out for them.
We did a full day planning event in New York pre-COVID when we were just the week of our launch to really shape what our vision was, and it was 8 hours of the most interesting exchanges, ideation, and just well done work in a limited time span from people with such different experience. They're just an amazing group, and everything that they get connected around just turns to gold. So we're so lucky to have them.
Well, seriously, you should consider like recording this in the terms of like putting a documentary of something together on this, because, you know, you have all of these great folks together in one room, you know, talking about things. And I just, you know, for historical purposes, to be able to record that and do a documentary on it, I think that would be fabulous.
Anyway. Oh, it's a great idea. I love it.
And I'm very excited to hear you talking about how, you know, you're bringing in all these people from, you know, different types of backgrounds with different types of experiences. You know, I talked recently on the podcast about multidisciplinary teams when it comes to legal matters, including experts across industries and professions and expertise. You've also focused on the multidisciplinary approach in this initiative. What expertise are you bringing in specifically, and what value is that giving the program to the students?
Multidisciplinary approaches to problem solving is at the heart of everything that FPI does, and it's perfectly aligned with the law school's tradition of taking a very interdisciplinary approach to legal education, which it has done for a very long time now. And it actually, I find this very interesting, goes back to Ben Franklin, who was the founder of the University of Pennsylvania. His entire notion of what education should be is deeply interdisciplinary. So, you know, from our roots a very long time ago till now, we really view that as the most efficient, effective, powerful way to become educated and solve the really thorny issues of our day. And so through FPI, what we've been able to do is really connect with I mean, the most fascinating people you could ever imagine meeting across Penn's community. So we are connected now with the Penn Engineering Entrepreneurship Program, the Integrated Product Design Program that is a collaboration with the Weitzman School of Design, Wharton, and the Engineering School. We're connected with the Graduate School of Education's Catalyst Program. We're connected with the Mack Institute of Innovation at Wharton. We're connected to Pennovation Works. We're connected with the Penn Center for Innovation. There's a whole community of people at Penn that are focused only on innovation and also learning innovation as a process and a methodology toward change, not just a buzzword or an idea or a fad or a cliche. And so we're part of the Penn Innovation and Entrepreneurship Group, which meets regularly to exchange ideas about how our friends over in nursing are solving problems for their patients and what we can learn from those solutions and the processes that they use to get to those solutions in legal. We had a call a few weeks ago with a colleague over at the design school. He's an architecture professor. And we described to him, he has no connection with the legal profession. We spent about an hour, Jim Miguel and I, on the phone with him and described some of the challenges around access to justice in a municipal court setting. And 24 hours later, he sent me 2 dozen ideas for ways that we could solve this problem. And, so, you know, things that we would have never thought of as lawyers, because he's ideating in the way that he's trained to ideate. And what I love about it is that there's this curse of knowledge, right? When you're in the legal profession, you already sort of know what can't work because of the regulations, because of the culture, because of whatever constraint there is. But when you bring in outside perspectives, they're not burdened by these limitations. And maybe their ideas are not going to work wholesale in the way that they've presented them. But there's a kernel there that we can take to use towards solving problems in legal. And if you put me in an MRI machine when I walk around Penn and I listen to these fantastic innovators, all these different and new parts of my brain would light up because I'm hearing things that I can connect to legal that I never thought about before. So that is really how we're plugging in with our innovation community. And everything that we do through FPI, we bring in somebody from another field to be a guest expert. At our conference that I mentioned, we had a panel that our dean hosted with the heads of Penn Nursing, the chief innovation officer from Penn Medicine, and the outgoing leader of Penn's health system to talk about how the healthcare system has been redesigned and what legal professionals can learn as a result. They face very similar challenges, and yet their delivery system has changed so much more than ours has. So it is a hallmark of everything we do is interdisciplinary approaches to problem solving. And it's I mean, aside from being just a great way to think in new directions and design new solutions, it's just fun to learn about what is happening in other fields.
Yeah, it's kind of like, cool, I never thought about it that way, you know?
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's so fascinating.
Yeah. You know, sometimes it does take someone coming in and going, well, why don't you try this? And to kind of shake you out of that.
You talk yourself out of even trying anything.
Yeah, and it's not – what I'm learning is we think lawyers are challenged in different and unique ways from other professions. We're not that innovative. We're so based on precedent. But the reality is when you go out and you talk to people in other disciplines, I would say – 90% of the time they say doctors are exactly the same. Nurses are exactly the same. Tech software developers are exactly the same. They're all, and I think in part because it's so siloed. So you're surrounded by people trained the same way with the same experiences. And I'll give you an example. At our last PIEG meeting, which is our university-wide innovation meeting, the nursing school highlighted one of their students who has been profiled in the New York Times and Good Morning America, all over the place. But he and his colleagues developed a little light that nurses can clip onto their lapel that's an LED light. So when they go in to deliver medication in the middle of the night, their patients don't have to be bothered by turning the light on in the room, right? And when they were presenting this idea, which is so simple, it's just a little tiny clipped light on your lapel, they were saying when we presented it at this hackathon, nurses were saying, why didn't I ever think of that? I hate bothering my patients by turning on the light. So nurses have been doing that forever, you know, disturbing people's rest. But you need new perspectives to come in and take a look at a situation with fresh eyes and say, why don't you just keep the lights off and find another way to illuminate only what you need to illuminate? So where is our light on the lapel in the legal profession, and who will help us find that?
Remind me when this is over, and I'll tell you about another nursing innovation that I heard of a few years ago.
The chief innovation officer at our nursing school is, I don't think she ever sleeps. She does so many programs, but she takes the position that nurses are natural innovators. They're solving problems all day long, and it's baked into what they do.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, the FPI, I believe, started back in 2019, right? Is that
correct? October 2019.
You know, your timing couldn't be more perfect than to start in the fall of 2019. So, you know, the challenges of the last year. So I want to just kind of see how that's affected you, the initiative in the law school. You know, have you adjusted over the last year in this, you know, basically a forced experiment that COVID has given us in the traditional teaching model? And then on top of that, there's also been the cultural challenge and shift, specifically with the confrontation with racial issues in the U.S. as a result of the George Floyd murder. Has there been any effect on you, the program, or the school during this time?
So I think, first, I just want to acknowledge how horrifically tragic the last year has been for across the board for so many people. And, you know, to extract some positive lessons, I suppose, from what we've experienced over the last year, what I think we were able to do, and you noted the timing being particularly interesting because we had just launched, and at our conference, which was February 27th and 28th in 2020, we framed it as the challenges the profession would face over the next 10 years, when really we could have framed it over the next 10 days, because everything was turned on its head 2 weeks later. What we were able to do was, because we already had a fully formed vehicle to explore changes in the profession, we were able to continue those conversations that started at that great conference throughout the pandemic, through webinars, through podcasts. I mean, I found myself in March of last year sitting here sort of like a chicken with my head cut off. I just got up every day and kept trying to do meetings and trying to do calls. And really, at a certain point, you have to stop and think, what can I do that's helpful in this moment, that is appropriate in this moment, and that I could do from home with nothing? So that's how the podcast started, because I had a microphone and I had a computer. So we were able to record conversations in real time. Jim, our senior consultant, was the head of the COVID-19 task force for the ABA. So he was our first guest on to talk about what is the ABA thinking about right now. And if we think back to that time, it was such an unknown what was going to happen in the year ahead. And so we were able to bring those conversations to life in real time. And you mentioned the reckoning around racial justice from last summer. I think the conversations in the profession really shifted in tone at that moment in what I think are important ways. We went from having sort of more amorphous conversations around diversity and inclusion to having really, really frank conversations about racial equity in our society and in our profession. And one of the things that we like to pride ourselves on is not shying away from difficult conversations. And we hosted a webinar over the summer on the future of racial equity in the legal profession. And it was a very candid, raw conversation about the failures in our profession to advance Black talent in our law firms and in our legal systems in particular. And so I think that we were able to lead and be part of that conversation in real time, whereas if we hadn't yet existed, we would be scrambling to come up with a way to coordinate those calls, to develop a community, and the community was already in place. So we were able to plug into that very quickly and sort of ride along with the conversation. And with the teaching aspect, the law school had in-person teaching for the entire year, which our colleagues did amazing work at the law school to ensure that that was still an option for our students. So I would say that legal educators on the whole learned a great deal about how to leverage technology in their teaching. And while we'll always be a physically based law school in Philadelphia, we now know that we have the flexibility to integrate different elements to bring in amazing speakers from around the world, by the way. One of the things I've realized, I've been teaching for 8 years, was that I only ever brought in people from New York and Washington because it was the only way that I could get somebody.
They could commute easily.
Right. Yeah. They could take a Acela and be there in an hour. Now I have people visit my class who are in the UK, who are in Israel, who are in New Zealand and Asia. And that won't go away. Tomorrow I'm doing a webinar in India. That would not have happened pre-COVID. And so I think that just the expanse and the knowledge base that we'll be able to take advantage of after this is over and behind us, we hope, will really change the lens in legal education.
Mm-hmm. So how are law firms, courts, and industries who Penn Law has a relationship with, how are they reacting to the initiative? I imagine positively.
It's been very, very positive. In fact, it was a little bit overwhelming at the beginning. I wasn't totally prepared for how excited people would be in our community, which was fantastic. I would say that I usually pride myself on very rapid responses to email, and they took much longer to respond to after we launched than before.
You didn't do the 24-hour rule?
I had to abandon it. It just was not possible. But people, you know, I think people out in practice recognize that the world is changing. They see it in their roles. And especially for our alumni, they're grateful to have the conversation and to really have a partner in helping them think through how they're leading their organizations, how their practice is changing. And so I would say very positive across the board.
Okay. Well, for the last question, there's kind of a series of questions. So we wanted to kind of make this into a speed round where we throw you some industries and you tell us what it is that you think they can do in the future, what changes or adjustments that they need to do in order to thrive in the future. And so I'll start off. What is it that law schools could be doing better in the future? And that includes students, faculty, and support staff.
So I think we've talked about it a lot, but I really think the key to the future in helping students navigate ambiguity is bringing in more multidisciplinary perspectives into the curriculum. I was on a call the other day where somebody was talking about how in their law school classroom, they have a project where the students have to find an expert in another field to help them solve this legal challenge. It can't be a legal professional. Things like that, that are simple adjustments. I think sometimes we think, you know, making change requires huge disruptive ideas or enormous resources. And sometimes it's just a small tweak like that. I think educating students about the change in the profession, about the system's failures, and about how they can be part of shaping a better future for the legal profession and couching it in optimistic and positive terms. It can be scary for law students to hear that the legal profession is changing really rapidly right as they're arriving. But the great news is so many students are coming to law school now with a real interest in social justice and in serving all of society and the health of our society. And that's not only students interested in the public interest anymore. That's most of our students are interested in these topics. So helping them understand where we failed and where they can help us and what opportunities there are for them to make it better. And I would say greater alignment with a rapidly changing profession, which is really what FPI is designed to do, to really be that connector between the law schools and the profession itself so that we can learn quickly and respond quickly and be a real partner to the profession.
Okay, I think we kind of killed the idea of the lightning round.
Sorry.
And that last answer.
Welcome to me.
It was great. It was a great answer, though.
Law schools are her forte, so
okay.
Maybe
I'll be faster
a little
next
quicker
time
than the other one.
No pressure or anything.
None. Right. So I'm ready to go.
Mine are law firms, partners, associates, non-partner track, and allied professionals.
All right, stop using lawyer, non-lawyer vocabulary.
Oh my God, thank you.
You're welcome. Build real infrastructure in-house to support innovation projects and spend at least a small percentage of your resources dedicated to those projects. And use this strange time as a real opportunity for radical collaboration with your clients, learning what they really value and where you can really improve and feed that into your innovation infrastructure. Was that shorter?
Much faster.
That was brilliant too.
So what about courts? And that includes, you know, federal, state, local, and I'll even throw in like legal aid and access to justice professionals. What could they be doing better?
So I would say Chief Justice McCormick in Michigan is a really great example of a judge who is trying to capture what is happening right now in our courts during COVID and making sure that we don't lose the opportunity to take that experience and create better court systems for everybody in the future. So I would say courts need to be thinking now about how their use of technology, data, and their experience in navigating a crisis can inform a better court system on the other side. I would also say law schools tend to focus almost exclusively on the federal court system. And most people's lives are impacted not at the federal level, but at the state and local level. So bringing in more opportunities for students to learn about what the challenges are for self-represented litigants in local and state courts and how we can be designing better systems there. And I'm channeling Jim Sandman when I say that law school presents an idealized version of appellate court litigation that was litigated with quality lawyers on both sides throughout, which is, as Jim would say, a complete fiction as compared with the reality. It's not me. This is Jim speaking, and he's right. So I think paying attention to all of our court systems and making sure that we're teaching students about them and how to make them better.
Okay, so how about bar associations and professional associations and all, things like, regulatory changes, how do they respond to that or certification changes?
Yeah, I think this is a really challenging one because there's so many different stakeholders in the system and we're not designed to move very quickly as a whole. And it's also really not my area of expertise, so it will be a quick answer. But I think I'm looking at NALP right now is doing a really good job of thinking strategically about the role that it has in the legal profession and how it can be using that role to advance progress. So I think stepping back and thinking about the power that an individual association has in being part of the change and part of the conversation is an important first step to strategic planning around taking next steps to keep up and to be moving along with the other dynamics that are changing legal practice.
And last but not least, what about things like vendors, consultants, those that are industry support? What can they do to change?
I would say step back by asking yourself, what is the actual problem that you are trying to solve for your client? And I've learned this from my friend who works in software development, that people who develop tech love to develop tech that they want to use. And it ends up being a solution in search of a problem. But if they actually engage with their client, get to understand through empathy interviews, understand their pain points, and then develop solutions that are actually integrated into their business model, that is helpful, but the rest is really not helpful. So that would be my advice.
All right. Well, Jennifer Leonard, thanks for taking the time to talk with us about the Future of the Profession initiative there at Penn Law. This has been very enlightening.
Yeah, thank you, Jennifer.
Oh, thank you both so much for having me on and to Adam for connecting us. It was a pleasure.
Well, Greg, I really just don't know where to start on this. It's like there are so many good things. First of all, Pennovation, great. And she was talking about how they're talking about not only, local types of impact, but global impact. So, it's a really broad topic. And, I love that it's not just Penn students that are benefiting from this, that they're looking at other schools and how other schools can benefit. They're trying to create problem solvers of the future and have people understand that in order to be that, you really have to be a lifelong learner. I mean, it's continual learning as you go forward in your career.
I think that the 5-year out academy is, that's such a no-brainer anymore because, one, it keeps you connected with your students and having, every time I've talked with a university or a Penn Law graduate, they're a Penn Law graduate because they tell you within 5 minutes of meeting them that they went to Penn Law. So, which is a good thing. Keeping that connection with your graduates to focus on, okay, now that you're, right at the end of the beginning of your career, here's the next steps. Here's the things that you have to worry about. And I think mentioning, especially for those that may transition into government, that's a different animal than if you've worked in law firms. There's so many traps you have to run in government. And so I think that's just a brilliant idea.
Well, I mean, it's a great alumni, you know, it's a great alumni tool to sort of engage your alumni and keep your alumni close. And honestly, I mean, I know firms are sort of working on alumni programs now too. It's like they ought to think about something like this in order to bring people and keep them engaged with the firm. And the other thing I was thinking about, like when she was talking about this, it reminded me so much of our interview with Jen Bluestein about, you know, the mid-year success, mm-hmm. you know, advice. And so this is the same sort of thing. You know, you kind of get a refresher on, hey, what here's what you should be aware of. And, you know, here's what to do in terms of transitioning into your next steps for your career.
Yeah, yeah. I still don't know how they manage time with all of those brainiacs in the room.
Because, you know, everybody had to have something to say, right? there were no wallflowers in that group.
That's for sure.
Well,
that's for sure.
So I am very excited about this, and I hope they do figure out how to make that light on the lapel for legal.
Yeah. Well, thanks again to Jennifer Leonard up at Penn Law and the Chief Innovation Officer there, as well as the Executive Director for the Future of the Profession Initiative. It's a great program, and I wish them well. But before we go, we wanted to remind listeners to take the time to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcast, and take the time to rate and review us as well. If you have some comments about today's show or suggestions for a future show, you can reach out to us on Twitter at GayBauerM or at Glambert. You can call the Geek & Review hotline at 713-487-7270, or you can email us at geekandreviewpodcast.com.
And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thanks, Jerry.
Yeah, thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, I will talk with you later.
Okay, bye-bye.